You're listening to Face Off, episode 83, recorded August 23rd, 2010. Welcome to Face Off, your face-to-face web technology podcast. I'm one of your hosts, Jade Robbins.
And I'm Mark Sanborn.
And in this podcast, we talk about various aspects of web technology, such as web development, social media, and web entrepreneurship. As always, you can view our show notes for this episode by going to faceoffshow.com.
All right, so I'm coming in via Skype again. Yeah. I've been so busy this summer doing camping and all kinds of stuff that I actually haven't made it to your house to record in quite a few episodes.
I know. You haven't seen my kitty in a long time.
And you haven't seen mine.
I know. How is your kitty?
He's doing all right. they can be a handful at times.
Yeah, mine is a spaz. He's kind of a spastic kitty. So it's interesting. Like I walk around the halls and he just all of a sudden he's like, leg.
Yeah, they like to do that. So the worst thing is like when you're like trying to hook up something and you got wires hanging around that just biting at them and falling them.
It's kind of crazy. Gotta love the kitties. All right, hey, let's get into our geek tool of the week. Our geek tool this week is the Thermos Nissan 2456P 18-ounce stainless steel hydration bottle. I don't know if we've talked about them specifically before, but you and I have water bottles. We have stainless steel ones. I've heard that you don't want to use aluminum because it can react with stuff in the water. I'm not really sure if that's verified or not, but stainless steel is about the same price, so you know that's what I go for. Well, the problem I have with mine, though, is I don't like super cold water. I'm just one of those guys. I like kind of like just chilled water. I don't like it, you know, really cold from the fridge, or ice water is not really my thing. So, but the problem with that is if I put, you know, just sort of mildly cold water in my regular sort of stainless steel water jug, then it gets warm like instantly, you know, because, mm-hmm. you know, they transfer heat really well. So the Thermos one is really cool because it's stainless steel on the outside and the inside. If you get this one, you can get also ones with plastic on the outside and stainless. I think plastic, maybe stainless steel that's painted, but it's stainless steel on both sides. So it's, you know, really durable. And it's non-reactive on the inside. There's no BPA. So this one's really cool because it's insulated. So if you do like really cold water, you can put really cold water in it and it'll keep it cold for a long time. You know, it's got sort of that famous thermos insulation, you know. I don't know if you ever had like a thermos, like the thermos. It's one of those things, it's kind of like Kleenex, you know. You say a thermos and you kind of mean like an insulated coffee jug.
Mm-hmm. Well, isn't this one actually a thermos? It says it.
Yeah, this is Thermos brand, so it's got really good insulation. The other cool part too, this is kind of like the reason that we like the our OXO Good Grips, is you put the top down. It's got a flip top. You put the flip top down, you can lock it so that, you know, if it doesn't pop open and spill everywhere. And also having that flip top is really nice because if you're like me, what drives me nuts about my water balls is the screw top on them. None of them seem to screw very well. I don't really like them. And so I just have like three water balls floating around without a lid on them right now, which doesn't make them very useful for like, hey, I need to go. Let's just grab this and head out the house. So if you have this, the flip top's got a little button. You push it and the top flips open. You can drink it. Also being insulated, it doesn't sweat either, which I get with my my water balls currently too. The sort of water can, you know, condensates on the outside, and then you get like a little sweat ring on whatever you have it sitting on, or it's just kind of wet on the outside, and I don't like that. So if you have this thermos one, it'll insulate it for you so that it isn't, you know, cold to the touch on the outside and therefore doesn't get water condensating on it. Really cool. I mean, you got to drink a lot of water.
Yeah, and it also said, you know, I don't know if it's an older thing, but the thermos used to have like a glass layer. And you kind of had to be careful of them breaking. This one does not have that, so that's good to
know. Yeah, it's literally stainless steel on the inside and the out, which makes it really durable. It's got insulation in between it. Check it out. It's only like $17. You can also, I think you can get them, like I saw one at our local Target for, I think, $12 maybe. Huh. But really
cool.
You know
what else is weird is like they have 5 stars and it's 148 reviews. Like not even like 4.5, 5 all the way stars and 148 reviews. Yeah. This is like a very popular water bottle.
Yeah, people really like it. So check it out. Go to our show notes to get the link. You can buy it off of Amazon for only $16.58. Really cool. The Thermos Nissan 18-ounce stainless steel hydration bottle. All right. So let's get into our web apps of the week. Our first web app comes to our way because from Eric Wendelin, who's a friend of ours. We had him on the show. It is getref.org. So you and I were big fans of distributed version control. You use Mercurial and Git. I tend to just use Git. Both of them are really cool, but there is kind of a learning curve. Some people, the biggest thing I've heard from most people is that they don't like the learning curve, especially if you're used to Subversion. It's hard to learn. If you don't do any version control, it's pretty easy to get into, but if you're used to Subversion, it can be kind of a pain. So this is where getref.org comes in to help you out. It's just a really good, clean, simple Git reference for people. You know, it tells you sort of the commands. You can have it has a flow on the bottom that so you can like navigate to the next item, and it kind of tells you, you know, like this is the initial stuff you have to do. This is the basics. This is, you know, then it gets into branching and merging and then sharing. Really useful if you want to get used to using Git.
Nice. The only thing that I always forget because I don't do it often enough is like reverting code.
Yeah.
And it would be good to have like a reference. It's like, how do I screwed up everything. How do I get back again?
Yeah. So, you know, it's really nice. It's kind of got each command. It tells you about what each command does, and then it gives you some examples of how to use it. And then it kind of tells you how this fits into this particular workflow, you know. So I'm looking at like git commit right now, or git reset actually. And it's kind of saying like, this is why you're going to want to use git reset, and this is how to use it and how helpful it can be. So check it out, and, you know, seriously give distributed version control a try if you aren't right now. I like Git and Mercurial. I think they're both cool. They're both pretty similar. There's, you know, pretty minute differences.
Yeah, I use them both, and I'm happy with both of them, actually. I mean, they're a little different. Some of the commands are actually identical, and some of them have the same name, but they do totally different things. So it can be confusing at times, but
absolutely,
I like them.
So check it out, getref.org. All right, our next web app. This is so, you know, there's everything out there on the web, blogs and news and stuff. They all seem to have RSS. We like XML RSS. It's a really great syndication medium. But if you're a programmer, you're often really used to working with JSON. You know, I like JSON. I think it's a lot cleaner. It's easier to read. So what our next web app does is called JSONduit. Is it takes any feed off of a website and turns it into JSON for you, which makes it a lot easier to interact with JavaScript. I mean, it's sort of it's JavaScript. What does it stand for? JavaScript object notation, I think. So, you know, it's very native to JSON. It works really well in JSON, but also things like, you know, if you're using Ruby on Rails, I'm sure there's tons of really good libraries of PHP for it. You know, it's becoming a really good medium for programmers and APIs.
Also, isn't there a JSON parse built into JavaScript?
Right. Yeah. Yeah. I mean, it's native.
So, I mean, it's ready to go. You don't have to import an extra library or anything.
I think IE7 doesn't have one, which sucks. But so you know, I like JSON a lot. So JSON, what's really cool, it says that it can turn practically anything on the web into JSON, which is, you know, probably true. It's really easy if you want to use like an RSS feed. But the cool part about it is if you want to create a new feed, a new JSON feed, is you go in and you create a new feed, you put the description, you put in the URL, and then you hit like load data source, and it'll sort of load the data. And then below that, you get to write JavaScript code that actually will transform the data source. So if it doesn't figure it out natively enough for you, you actually then can write JavaScript that will happen every time you pull it, that will do things like parse it and make it the right way. And then, you know, in the end, you know, you click run transform and it shows you the JSON that it will actually output.
Interesting.
Yeah, so it's like a really good way if, you know, if you're a programmer, you're writing lots of little sort of things that you want to use JSON for, and you're getting tired of having to parse XML, RSS, or even just a web page that doesn't have that at all, give JSON to it a try. It's in beta. But it's really cool. It came to us from our friend Rob Lund. So he was pretty excited about it. And I think it's a great, great app.
Excellent.
Yeah. So grab some JSON, do some mashups and some integrations. APIs are always really cool. And well, actually, that's a great segue into our topic this week,
which is APIs, actually.
Ooh. So I guess I've heard API all the time, but what does it actually stand for?
Well, it stands for Application Programming Interface. Sometimes people refer to it as like Advanced Programming Interface or something like that, but it actually stands, according to Wikipedia, it's Application Programming Interface.
So a lot of times we browse the web or we use our applications, you know, they're really designed for humans. You know, you work on layout and stuff like that to make it look really nice and everything so that it's easy for a human to use. But really, APIs are designed for an application, for a computer. It's, you know, they're supposed to be a way for, you know, like to talk to it programmatically in ways that a computer can understand and parse quickly. And then you, you know, and then you use it yourself. So like, I use someone's API in my application.
Yeah, it's a great way to say it. It's like if the website's the user interface for the human, the API is the user interface for a computer.
Yeah.
So, you know, why do one? Well, they can be a company's greatest asset. You know, you need to think like Twitter and Facebook apps here. If it wasn't for Twitter's great API, we wouldn't have all these great applications and these great services like CodeTweet and all these different things that we've talked about.
Totally.
Facebook really exploded when they started having games and applications. And somewhat, I mean, it can be a hassle to some people too. But I mean, it really started opening the doors to what can happen on Facebook. It's more of like a marketplace now, really.
Right. I mean, it creates a platform. So rather than just being an application, it creates a platform which other applications can be built and integrated from.
Right. So the benefits of that is customers invest heavily. That, you know, there's companies that are based, I mean, their whole company is based on Twitter's API.
Yeah, exactly.
So, I mean, that once they're invested, it's, you know, the cost is really great to stop. So they're going to use your service.
Yeah, definitely.
So that those right there are very powerful reasons to open up and have an API. Some of the downsides are, you know, a poorly designed API can lead to just an endless amount of support calls or emails. Also, public APIs are kind of forever. You only have one chance to get it right. You know, if you put out something and it's getting used by lots of people, it can be really, really difficult to change the way that works or what they get back.
Right.
It's hard to say, oh, by the way, we're going to take that back away from you now.
Yeah.
You get a lot of heat from your customers.
Yeah, so. Exactly. You have to do sort of the, you know, resistance to change management where you have to notify people really early, notify them often of the change because so, yeah, I mean, if you're not careful with the API, one other thing, too, is if you have a poorly designed API, you said that, you know, it can lead to endless support calls. But I think another big thing is if you just have a poor API, it will lead to just very low adoption.
True.
You know, no one wants to use a really junky API. They'll just skip it and say, well, no, you know, I know that Twitter and Flickr have been around for a while and there's a lot of people using them. So, you know, I'm going to invest in those instead.
Yep. You know, and we say kind of forever, but you can, you know, change them. You know, some of the APIs, for example, I can give you some examples. Some of the APIs that I use, they give you like a year notice that something's about to change, and then they'll give you like 10 more emails between the time it changes. Right. And so,
or I've seen some with different versions, so you know, you can use like the sort of pretty basic 1.0 API that they first released the app with, or if you want, you can use a more advanced 2.0 API, and they're gonna, you know, they'll tell you like, hey, we're gonna sunset the 1.0 API in 2 years, so don't come crying to us when all of a sudden your stuff doesn't work.
Yeah, that's another way of doing it. But for the most part, you know, things are kind of there forever, so it's one of those things you got to be really careful when you're designing it. So, so we'll talk about kind of the ways to design it. So, some good characteristics of a good API. It should be easy to learn. And it should be easy to use even without documentation. So things like the names of the functions or the tasks should be kind of self-explanatory.
Yeah, they should be intuitive. You should kind of just be like, yeah, well, that makes sense. I'm getting tweets, so you know, I'm going to use this function.
If you remember our episode about REST, when you do REST APIs, it's a lot of the things are kind of designed the same way, like you do a delete statement to delete that object,
yeah,
and things like that. So those can kind of tie in there.
Totally.
A good API should, you know, is going to be hard to misuse. That you're not going to have, you know, functions with similar names that you might end up accidentally deleting something that you know didn't intend to.
Yeah, that would be very frustrating.
It's good. It should be easy to use and maintain the code that uses it. It should be easy to extend. It should be appropriate to the audience. So it should do, basically, it should do what the audience kind of wants it to do and not like what the programmer finds easy to implement. You know, he might be like, well, this function's easy. It's good for me. But, you know, your users may not use it at all. Which, yeah, we'll talk about a little bit on how to like design your API and picking you know, going through use cases actually totally. To decide what things should be in your API. Good APIs let you get a lot done with a few lines of code. You know, posting to Twitter is a kind of a good example. You know, one line of code, really, you can post something to Twitter.
Yeah.
And you could schedule a tweet, for example. That's a useful thing that can be done with like one line of code.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. You don't want it to be really, really, really difficult to do something very simple, because the whole point is that, you know, you want it to be quick and easy. API adoption, a really important part is ease of use, so that if people can integrate quickly, then they're willing to invest in that time much more readily, because they're not going to feel like they're dumping 12 hours into something that's going to disappear in a week. You know, if they only have to dump an hour into it, then it's like, oh, well, that's just an hour. And if they go away, then there's no big deal. I've only lost an hour of time. But if it takes them all day to figure it out and use it, you know, they're going to have to make sure that there's a really good use case before they do that ahead of time.
Another one is like, if I can just give a string, you know, just an address string to Google and they return a map to me with a geolocation, that's a lot of work that got done with just a string of an address. You
yeah.
know? Yeah. If I had to give them first the address and then this, I don't know, even that would be a lot. Like, I wouldn't have to draw my own map and like try to figure out the lat and long, you know,
oh, yeah.
for this location, like go out and do a geo coding on this address and then take that address. You know, yeah. So a lot of stuff is getting done with just a little bit of code.
I had a friend that was cursing the Google Maps API like 2 days ago, and I said, oh, cool, dude, we'll write your own map application. I'm really curious to see how it goes. And it's like, it's true. It's amazing what you can do with Google Maps. It's great API.
Actually, and Google Maps is one of the most used API I found on, according to Programmable Web. So let's get into designing a good API. The first thing is to get requirements from actual use cases. You kind of don't want to skip this step, because you tend to get more than what you actually need if you just kind of say, well, let's make this crazy awesome API that does everything, you know?
Yeah, exactly.
The problem with doing that is it's easy to add things to an API. It's really hard to take things away. So if you put some feature on there, then you end up thinking later, well, maybe we don't want our users doing that. It's like a lot more difficult because people are actually using that code.
Yeah.
Start with a simple one-page spec. This is helpful because you actually kind of have all the developers are kind of on the same page. This is the specification. We've talked about specifications before. It's good to have just like a simple one-page one, because it's easier to change that if you've got this big, long, detailed spec of like 10 pages long. You know, it tends to not get updated.
Yeah, I mean, just start it and get the basics down, and then, you know, show it off to people and see what they have to say.
Yeah, bounce it off to as many people as possible, because APIs have to really be designed well, because we've been saying this, but it's kind of forever. So it's one time to get it right, so make sure you kind of get at least the design part of it out to as many people as possible.
Yeah, totally.
If you can, use your own API. We're kind of doing this in our app that we wrote. We basically kind of wrote the app or the API part of it and then started utilizing that for our interface. And it really, really helps. Even if it's just a reminder to yourself that, you know, if we change the API just a little bit, we have to go back into our own code and just change everything.
Yeah, exactly.
You know, it keeps the API consistent that way. And it also... it helps you write the documentation better too, because you have insight into how the API works and
what
doesn't work, what features you'd like to have that you don't have, things like that.
Yeah, I mean, that's really what we found out. It's like when you start documenting it, if you're documenting well, then you really have to use it, and then you really find sort of the little goofball things about it that drive you nuts.
Yep. And so let's say your app is already made and you know you're just now getting to the API, so you can't start with making the API first. Write a few tools to utilize your own API, just so you can kind of use your own API. Basically, get a few of the same advantages there. It's highly recommended. Your functions or the different modules of your API should do one thing and that one thing well. If it's something that's kind of hard to name, if you're finding yourself, you know, looking for a name and you can't think of what it should be called, it's generally a bad thing.
Right. You
maybe you should split it up. Maybe it's doing too much stuff.
Yeah, you want your users to do the integration of fun stuff with it. That's the whole point. You know, oftentimes you're either, if you're doing too much, it won't be done well, or, you know, if you're not doing enough, then they really can't do anything. But it's usually, you know, functional little snippets that they can then do themselves, because that's sort of the benefit of the API, is that you don't have to put in all these tools for them, because you're going to let them be creative. And odds are you won't think of all of the use cases that someone will use for it. You never know. They'll do something crazy and you're like, oh, well, great. I didn't have to do that because, you know, they did it for me because they're awesome.
Yeah. You know, Twitter started off with just like a status, and then all of a sudden then they have tags and lists and all these things that like basically the users came up with, you know?
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely.
When in doubt, leave it out. You can always add to the API. If you're getting just tons of requests from people that you should add something, you probably should, but don't just go adding a bunch of things willy-nilly, because again, it's harder to remove them. And like you said, like if you just have the basics, people will tie them together and make stuff that you might not have even thought of. So
yeah.
You don't always have to have everything in there. The name should be self-explanatory. You know, just looking at an example should kind of say what you're, you know, what's going to happen here, what the result is going to be. Avoid like just crazy abbreviations that you have no idea what it is.
Yeah, I mean, think about it. Again, this is a programmatic interface to your application. So, you know, maybe someone might get, you know, they're only going to be writing the code once for it, you know, hopefully, right? Mm-hmm. So, you know, if the names are long and stuff, that's fine. Clarity over cleverness there, because, you know, after they write it once, the program does it and it doesn't really matter if it's a long name.
Right. Be consistent. If you do have like an abbreviation for something and you're using it in your names throughout the app, make sure it's the same, you know, abbreviation or whatever. Or if you're using underscores versus hyphens or whatever like the case may be, just be consistent there.
Yeah.
Because programmers kind of, they'll start using, you know, functions, and then they'll assume that this other functions should be the same, because that's, they're just consistent that way. And so do that.
Yeah, totally.
Provide a programmatic access to all the data that comes back, that is available like as a string. You don't want your client, you know, the people that are connecting to your API to have to like parse through stuff. If you have like a list of things, maybe have them in JSON as a list or XML or whatever. Make sure they're able to loop through them, as opposed to having to parse, you know, CS, you know, comma separated values.
Yeah,
or exactly.
Yeah, that would be a terrible API. Just return CSV. Oh, miserable.
You know, it's one of those things. It's like, it seems obvious when you kind of think about it, but people might not think.
All right. So like the key, as we talked about, to any API is documentation, documentation, documentation.
Exactly. You should be documenting religiously, you know, things to include in your document when you're, for each kind of module, is the syntax, the parameters, you know, the input parameters that you're going to be sending to it. Even if it's, let's say it's Google Maps and you're sending addresses, even a description of the state, you know, could be helpful. You could say, yeah, you know, the state is also the state or province. Examples would be MT for Montana, you know, because just because it says state and you think it's obvious as a programmer, totally, maybe it's the abbreviation, maybe it's MT, or maybe it's the full thing state, or maybe you can send both, you know.
Yeah, exactly.
Be clear there.
Totally.
So have descriptions of each you know, input parameter. Also have details on the return values, what the programmer can expect, so that they can write exceptions and they're expecting a certain value, they should write accordingly. Give examples. A lot of times they do this with curl, something that, you know, a programmer can kind of copy and paste and try it and be like, oh, that was easy, that's cool. They get something right away, you know?
Yeah, I think examples are very key to this whole process, because sometimes I find, I mean, documentation, even good documentation, can kind of be a pain unless there's examples, because then you really sort of see, you know, the flavor of it and how it uses it. Like, oh, this would be how someone would use it like this. Okay, you know, or, you know, here's an example in curl. Oh, that's really easy for me to implement in JavaScript because it's JSON and I just need to do, you know, an AJAX call. And that, I mean, I think that really is very helpful. But, and also, like you said, just the ability to copy and paste and try it really quick and be like, oh, well, this does work. They're not just, you know, making it up and throwing it out there. It works and it's really easy.
Yeah, there's some really, it's really powerful to have a command that you can just copy and paste and you get something back. That's like, to the programmer, it's like, this is possible.
Yeah.
This exactly. is, I can do this, you know, like I got something already. I mean, here we go.
Yeah.
So it's good. Other things you can include is like a usage scenario. This can be used for, give them some examples, get their wheels turning. It helps with the adoption rate. Get some thinking about it. Also you might have like a related APIs. This function is related to this other one. This one affects this one.
Totally.
This one needs authentication before sending it, so please see the authentication.
Yeah, also, function. So you don't have to like, because I mean, I've done that before where I'm like looking at an API and I'm like trying to get it and it won't work. And I mean, that's a great example. Like, I forgot about the entire authentication piece because they don't really say, you know, just so you know, even though it may have seemed obvious, but I was just really angry because it's like, I didn't even think of that. And there was nothing in there about that. So check it out. APIs are very important. I think, with the sort of Mashable web that we have going on now, we're seeing it integrated more and more. Apps people are developing, they're kind of seeing that the importance of making sure they have an API because people really like them. So, hey, I didn't say this before, but if you have some news, a follow-up or web application or even a topic idea you want us to take a look at, let us know. Go to faceoffshow.com/feedback. Tweet us out. Send us an email. Do anything. That wraps it up for this episode of Face Off. I want to remind you guys that you can subscribe to the show by going to faceoffshow.com/subscribe. If you aren't subscribed yet, there's all different kinds of ways you can subscribe on there. You can also leave feedback for the show, like I said about going to faceoffshow.com/feedback. We tell you how to get a hold of us there. Thank you guys for listening, and we will see you next week.